Well, we just heard the word from headquarters.
Oh, this can't be good.
There are going to be layoffs.
What?
Starting tomorrow, one of you sitting at this table right now will no longer be with us.
See, this is one of those high-stakes conversations, right? Where emotions run strong, everybody's got a different opinion.
Oh, you think?
Settle down! Now look, I've come up with a fair and impartial way to handle this. You've all heard me talk about Timmy, right? It's my pet ferret.
Sweet Moses!
No, it's Timmy. I'm gonna set Timmy down here on the middle of the table, and whoever he scampers to, well, that person is fired.
Oh, crap.
Now, how many of you in the course of your careers have seen people go to extraordinary lengths to avoid talking about something uncomfortable? Have you seen that happen? You see people have to make adjustments to their financial strategies at home, to spending, to try to engage their spouse or loved ones or others in solving financial problems. And those conversations tend to be some of the most difficult we ever face. Now, the second premise of my time with you is, it isn't just them that have a difficult time talking about this. We've actually done some research with financial planners looking at how financial planners talk about very challenging things with their clients. And so our research in that domain has caused us to think there might be some relevance to the topic to you today as well. But rather than do this in the abstract, I want to actually ask you to roll up your sleeves and play with a couple of ideas today. So let me ask you to buddy up with somebody. It sounds like you had a partner before, but if you found them to be either unattractive or unintelligent, you might want to find a different one right now. So pair up, figure out who your partner is, pick a person A and a B, and I got a job for you here. Decide who's person A and who's person B between the two of you. All right. Okay, you'll switch roles once anyway, so both of you are going to be on the hot seat. So person A, your name is Nurse Bonnie. You're the woman on the left here in the video. If that requires some acting skills, you deal with it. The person on the right is person B. Your name is Dr. Scott. Okay? So all of you who are Bonnie in the room, raise your hand. Let me see who all the Bonnies are. Good. All right, Bonnies, you're on the hot seat to start with. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play this little interaction. You're going to watch an exchange between Nurse Bonnie and Dr. Scott. When I stop the video, the instant I stop it, I want you to turn to Dr. Scott, to your Dr. Scott, and say the next thing you would say if you were Nurse Bonnie. You ready? Okay, so no preparation. This is spontaneous. You're there. Here's what's happening. Get ready. I'll give you a 5-second warning before it's going to hit you. Here you are.
Can I get you to check in on Mr. Gonzalez before you take off? He's the older gentleman who had the punctured lung. We're hoping to release him.
I can. I got to get to my son's music assembly. Just, just tell him something came up and I'll come back tonight and check on him.
Actually, his family's all here expecting to take him home. I told him you were just down the hall. Please, it'll only take a minute.
You told him what?
I assumed it would be
get
okay.
Ready.
I thought you'd be right in.
Oh, you thought? And where did you learn to think? Certainly not some 2-year rinky-dink nursing school, that's for sure.
Okay. All right, Bonnie, turn to him. What do you say now? Certainly not some 2-year rinky-dink business school, nursing school. All right. Go ahead and stop if you got the first sentence or two out. So let me see. I know we're at the Harmon Center at BYU, but let me just sort of test the group here. How many of you began with the phrase, up yours? How many of you started there? Just a few. All right. How many of us, because we're in the Harmon Center, didn't say it but thought it? How many of you? So here's the challenge. We get into these circumstances, right? So you got a client who's made commitments and said we're going to put another $5,000 into our retirement account, and you're on the phone with them right now, and they just reported to you they bought a boat instead, right? These are the moments, right? These are the moments when we have to deal with something in a way that might be challenging, that is emotionally challenging, politically challenging. So the first part of the topic for the day is we get into these circumstances, but that isn't the reason that you and I should talk about them. Our research suggests that there's an even more profound reason that you and I ought to be talking about this, and it is essentially that the success or failure of our careers usually hangs on how we handle those moments. We might think it's attributable to all sorts of other things. We might think there are a variety of sort of planning and organizing and preparation and other things that we do, but these moments tend to have a disproportionate effect on results. The remarkable thing is that you and I tend to give them almost no thought until they happen. We tend not to deal with them in a particularly effective way. Now, over the years, as my colleagues and I have studied the topic, my children, just coincidentally along the way, have had science fair projects due. I don't know about your kids, but mine would come to me and say, "Dad, I'm struggling to come up with an idea, and what should I do a science fair project on?" My two oldest children are our daughters, and I would always suggest social science questions to them. And they would berate me and belittle me and tell me how stupid that was and that nobody does social science, and so we'd build a volcano and they'd be off to the science fair. And well, along comes Samuel, our second youngest child, and he comes to me and says, "Dad, I've got a science fair project due." And he said, "Do you have some ideas?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't have any good ones. What are you thinking of?" And he said, I think I'd like to do something on crucial conversations." I said, "Really? You clever lad." And he said, yeah, I think I want to do it on how little kids deal with crucial conversations." And at first I said, "I don't know, Samuel." I said, I've seen examples of how children deal with this. Any of you see those shows, Kids Say the Darndest Things? Have you seen those before? I said, "I've seen this before, and kids are kind of blunt. I mean, they're pretty open about their views." And he goes, no, Dad." He says, "I know what I want to do. He says, just help me carry it out." I want you to see what he discovered.
We all know adults stink at talking about tough things. But how about little kids? Here's my experiment. Feed kids wretched brownies, then see if they'll tell you the truth. Especially when they think it might hurt your feelings. First, I made the brownies. Lots of chocolate, eggs and flour, but instead of sugar, I put in salt. Lots of salt. There's no way they could like these better. Now I recruit kids of various ages for a taste test. I tell them I want to compare ordinary brownies to my special brownies. My dear grandmother's special recipe. My dear dead grandmother's special recipe. Then I give them a dollar for being such a big help. My parents always taught me that if you want someone to like you, give them money. Okay, here goes. First, they ate the yummy sugar brownies. Next, they eat the salt bricks. Watch this girl. She can hardly keep from gagging. And now for the crucial moment. Will they tell me the truth and possibly offend me? I asked them to point to the brownies they like best. No surprise that some tried to spare my feelings. But watch, even the one who gagged? And how about really little kids? But do you want to know what they really thought? Here, guys, I have leftovers. Does anybody want seconds?
Isn't that amazing? It just blew my mind. You know, the reason it blew my mind more than it may even yours is that I know these little kids. That girl Hannah, the one that with the puckered up face that was spitting out the brownie, and she lives right next door. And she is the most blunt, candid, open, suffers no fools little kid in the entire world. And she's lying about the brownies. She's saying she likes them. And so it was remarkable to me to see how young in age we begin this pattern of sugarcoating the truth, right? And this is what our clients expect of us. Our clients expect not just wisdom, but influence. Our clients expect us to help them do things that they wouldn't otherwise do without our assistance. And the question is, when I buy that boat, how does this conversation go? What happens in these circumstances? But let me broaden this beyond even just client interactions. For the past 25 years, the question that we've been asking is, are there moments of disproportionate influence in your life? So Archimedes said, if you had real levers, you could move entire planets. And our search has been for moments when your behavior disproportionately affects your influence with a client, your influence with colleagues, your influence in your organization. Are there moments that profoundly affect many kinds of results that you and I care about? That's what we've been after. And that's what led us in the direction of these crucial conversations. So about a year ago, my colleagues and I asked this question about financial planning. Now, I know we have a lot of different competencies reflected in the room, but this is one that I'll focus on here for a moment. We found that with some of our clients, they said that our financial advisors are losing clients like crazy in the financial downturn. How many of you have experienced any of that? Had some client leakage? How many of you won't admit it? So they found that people were putting less in, people were not sticking with their planners and so on. And what we were interested in was, are there differences between those who had higher client retention and productivity and those with lower? Wonder, is there anything in the behavior of the advisor? So not the strategies, not the products, not the processes. All of those are fairly uniform in organizations. But what about the behavior of individual financial planners? Would that make any difference? So let me ask you to do this. With your colleague, with your partner, I want you to ask our research question for a moment. What are some of the crucial moments that you face, whether you're a financial planner or not, but the crucial moments that you face with your clients that you think profoundly affect the course of the client relationship? What are some of the toughest moments to handle that you think disproportionately affect a lot of things downstream? So take 60 seconds and share your thoughts with your partner on that question. Well, let me ask you to hang on to some of those thoughts for a moment. We'll share some of our findings with you as well, but I want you to just sort of get into the mode, because the most important outcome of our discussion today, I hope, is that you start to see a principle that can help you identify a leverage point for profoundly improving the quality of results and relationships in your personal and professional life. But let me step back from that for a moment and have you take a look at this little interaction. So with your partner, I want you to watch an exchange here between two employees on the right and their boss on the left. And the reason I'm asking you to look at this is just to start thinking about impact. So after watching the exchange, I'm going to ask you to talk about two things. The first is, how would you describe the behavior of the employees on the right? That's question one. Question two is, if that kind of behavior happened a lot in an organization, what would the costs or consequences be? So question one, what are they doing? Question two, what are the costs or consequences if this were a common pattern in a relationship, in organizations, and so on? So here you go.
You know something, guys? I think if we ship by truck, we're going to be just fine.
That's right. Why pay for overnight services?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But is it worth the risk of it arriving late just to save the money, though? Mm.
You know what? You're right. I mean, a late delivery would be unacceptable.
Absolutely. Let's pay the additional fee.
Well, right.
I didn't mean to imply it wasn't worth it. I was just asking. But on the other hand, though, I don't want to pay for unnecessary fees either.
What were we thinking? I mean, money's too tight to be throwing it away. It's for shipping.
I'm with you.
Absolutely.
Guys, wait a minute. I have the feeling you're just deferring to me because I'm the boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what I'd rather do is just discuss the issues without worrying about who's saying what, okay?
You know what? You're absolutely right. From now on, I'm not going to defer to you anymore.
Me neither.
Right.
Okay.
Starting right now.
Good. Me too.
So, how am I doing?
How about me?
All right. So, question one, how would you describe their behavior? Question two, what would the costs or consequences be if that happened a lot in an organization? 60 seconds with your partner. Chat about it for a moment. So let's cover the first point really quickly. What are they doing? How would you describe that behavior? Anybody holler it out. Yeah, wimps. All right, good. We got people who are clearly not speaking their minds, right? Now rather than just use a cartoonish, exaggerated example, let's personalize the question for us in the room. So by show of hands, how many of us have ever said less than we think to somebody in a position of authority? How many of us have ever done that? Yeah. How many of us are still today because we're here today because we did? So we've all been here, right? We've all been in circumstances where we're not sure how candid, how open, you know. So what we say is that the brownies aren't my favorite, right? That's what we say, rather than the brownies are awful. We kind of sugarcoat or understate or completely defer in circumstances like this. Now, I want you to think for a moment about what the costs or consequences would be if this happened in client relationships, if this happened in an organization consistently, if this happened in our relationships with direct reports or colleagues. So if that pattern carried itself out, what would the cost or consequences be? Raise your hand if you have a thought on that. What would a cost or consequence be if that kind of behavior happened chronically? Yes?
There'd be no reason to have the employees.
Okay, good. No reason to have the employees if this happens honestly or frequently. How many people were needed for that conversation? Yeah. How many are we overstaffed by? Yeah. Yeah, good. All right, what else? What else would be affected if this happened frequently in an organization? Good. Could it affect client retention? Yeah. Creates a socialist environment? Is that a political comment, sir? All right. Yeah, it could affect client relations, couldn't it? If we start seeing damage to clients from practices or policies and those can't bubble up and we can't have ideas challenged, we keep selling brownies that don't sell. It definitely could. One more. What else? What else might be affected? Please.
Decrease the need for conversation at all.
Yeah. Decreases the need for conversation at all, he says. Have you ever been in a meeting where the meeting lasted an hour and everything was discussed except the real issue? Have you ever been in that meeting before? Yeah. And in many meetings, we find that the real thorny issues never find their way to the surface. In fact, if you remember the brownie video, where is the only place you get honesty? It's in the hallway, right? It's out there afterwards. And what is the cost or consequence for our ability or inability to hold these conversations? So I'm going to encourage you to write down three things today that I think are take-home value. One of them is the statement at the top of the page here. Our finding through 25 years of research and looking for these levers that move the world is this, that at the heart of almost all chronic problems in our relationships, in our teams, in our organizations, in our lives, at the heart of almost all chronic problems are crucial conversations that we either don't hold or don't hold well. Both of those are important parts to consider. So think about your personal relationships and our intimate relationships. At the heart of most of the chronic problems that we have are not just problems of expectation differences, problems of value differences, problems of, we'll have differences with everybody we ever encounter. At the heart of the chronic nature of these problems is our inability to either talk about it or talk about it well. Therein lies the problem. Same so with our client relationships and our organizations. So we've studied things like influence. We've studied folks like you in the room for 25 years and tried to find those who had the most influence, for example, with their clients, with their colleagues, peers, suppliers. Those who, in spite of the fact that they may not have the top title in an organization or the corner office or control all of the resources, seem to be able to get things done in a remarkably effective way. And what we found is that they differ from most of us in the room in these moments more than almost any other, in how they deal with politically and emotionally risky conversations. It's in those moments when they find a way to be absolutely honest, but do so in a way that maintains the relationship. So I'm not going to have a lot of time, and I don't think it's the best use of our time for me to just take you through a whole lot of the research, but one of these I do want you to experience. I want you to get firsthand. I think most of you have a copy of the little handout on crucial conversations. If you take that out, I'd like to invite you to use it for a moment. First thing I'd like you to do is open it up completely and tear off the right third of it. So there's a panel on the far right. When I conclude today, if you decide that you'd like to study the topic further, we have some resources that I can't hand to you here that we can make available to you online. You can get a free copy of the Brownie video. You can get access to online instruments and tips and advice. And so if you fill out the little card and hand that in, we'll be able to provide that to you through email. But what I want you to do is flip that over, and you'll see some lined pages on the back. And what I'd like you to do is write the numbers 1, 2, and 3 down the vertically on the left-hand side of the page. So 1, 2, and 3. And then I have a little task for you to do. Most of this you can just do verbally, but if you want to make some notes on it in 1, 2, and 3, you're welcome to do that too. The first one is, I want you to think of the name of somebody with whom you regularly work, about whom you've drawn a negative conclusion. Okay, so think of somebody you regularly work with, that you're frustrated with, that's disappointed. It could be a client, could be a colleague, could be a supplier. If it's the person seated immediately to your left or right, think of a different one for now so we can keep distractions to a minimum. But think of somebody whom you regularly work that you've got some frustrations and issues with. By show of hands, how many of you can think of somebody that qualifies for that description? Okay, good. Yeah, multiple ones, good. All right, so I want you to think of one, and at point number one on your page, I want you to write a few words that you would use to describe that person when you are frustrated with them. So write bluntly and honestly what you think of their brownies. Okay, no sugarcoating. Write it down. What conclusion have you drawn about them?
This is number two.
Point number one. Yeah. All right, question two. I'm going to ask you to think about now how the problems and concerns you have with that person affect your behavior. So let me give you a quick illustration here. Let's say you had a colleague that you went on a sales call with, and this happened.
So, thanks for agreeing to meet with us about your storage needs. I brought a junior sales associate with me today. This is Michael.
Nice to meet you.
You too. Well, I've looked at your proposal, and I have to say, I'm very interested.
Oh, that's great. As I've had a chance to review your backup infrastructure, and I don't want to be too critical here, but your platform is from when? The Jurassic era? Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
So, how about we jump into our recommended solutions?
Sure. I know our tape system is a bit of a dinosaur, but...
Okay, Michael.
Oh, okay. All right.
Thank you.
We were
okay.
hoping
Michael,
that
it's
our...
It's okay.
Work with you,
yes, Michael,
would increase
Mike.
So, do we have your business?
No.
You can imagine the conversation in the car on the way back to the office. So let me ask you, if you have a colleague with whom you have some concerns, has it started affecting your behavior towards them? And if so, how? Write down a couple of examples of how you behave differently with this colleague or another circumstance because of the problem that you have with them. All right. Now, with your partner, here's what I'd like you to share. You can write this on number three if you want or just do it verbally. I'd like you to turn to your partner and share with them just two things. Don't tell them who this person is. Don't tell them all your problems with that person. Don't do any of that. All I want you to share with them is a couple of examples of how you behave differently because of your frustrations or concerns and what the consequences are for how you're behaving differently, good or bad, either one. So what are the upsides or downsides to how you're dealing with it, and how are you dealing with it right now? Share it with your partner, 60 seconds apiece, real quick, real brief. Now, I know that's a real limited amount of time to think about something that might be kind of a complex situation, but let me just ask you a couple questions. First of all, how many of you could recognize ways that you're behaving differently because of your problem with that person? How many of you could see specific ways you're doing that? Good, very good. That kind of introspection, that self-awareness is really important. Now, let me ask you the important second question then. How many of you can see that the way you're responding to the problem right now might not be helping? Can you see ways that it might not be working? Good. Good. Very important for us to recognize. So when we have problems with colleagues, here's the big takeaway that I want you to leave with as we talk about this. Remember the principle. Remember what I shared earlier. At the heart of almost all chronic problems are what? Our crucial conversations were either what? Two things. Either not holding or not holding well. Our experience is that so many times when we start having frustrations and concerns, what happens is we start avoiding, we start bad-mouthing, we start undermining, we start doing everything except the thing that could potentially solve the problem, and that this has a profound effect on teamwork. When you have frustrations with a colleague, with a customer, with a boss, with a direct report, you have two options. You can talk it out. Now, do we know that talking makes a difference every time? No, we don't. But what we do know is that if you don't talk it out, you will act it out. It will affect your behavior. And that will create certain consequences to the relationship and to results and to the organization. So what you're trading is the possibility of an ineffective conversation for the certainty of bad relationships and bad results. That's the arithmetic we tend to do during these crucial moments. Does it affect productivity, marriages, diversity in organizations, quality, safety? Our research suggests that every one of these are profoundly affected on whether and how people handle those moments of disproportionate influence. At the heart of almost all of these chronic problems are crucial conversations we're not holding or not holding well. In our study with 256 financial advisors, we found 10 high-stakes conversations that folks like them faced on a regular basis. They ranged from talking to clients about foregoing purchases, cutting back on lifestyle, reallocating investments, some very difficult things to discuss. In some cases, we're messing with family dynamics. And the question is, do we shy away? Do we start saying the brownies are just not the best, as opposed to telling them what we really think of the brownies and undermining our influence? So we found, for example, things like this. Your client has lost substantial savings, lost their job, or is threatened with job loss, and you need to talk to them about changing some pretty significant ways in which their spend is taking place. We found that 46% of our financial advisors in the study said that this is a very or extremely likely conversation for me to have. The severe or very severe impact of it was substantial as well. Their ability to handle the conversation, a significant number felt incapable of it. What if your client isn't saving enough? For example, their house is too expensive, they have too many cars, or are simply spending at too high a rate. Once again, significant gaps in ability to handle this. What about your client is getting into too much credit card debt? They need to make serious and immediate lifestyle changes. Again, significant impacts. And then we ask the question, does your ability to handle those conversations predict client retention? So this is interesting. Many of us would assume that client retention would increase if we sometimes sugarcoat or don't handle these moments in an effective way. And it turned out the opposite was true. Turned out people who were able to absolutely candidly discuss these issues, but do so in a way that strengthened the relationship, actually experienced greater client retention, 42% versus 21% that handled these conversations well. So, first big point that I wanted to share was essentially this. These are those moments of disproportionate influence. When that woman is sitting down with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and has a moment to exert some influence, how we handle that moment profoundly affects outcomes and what follows. And what we tend to do is handle it in precisely the worst way we could. We move either to silence or to violence. We move either to silence and start sugarcoating, or we move to violence and start pounding the table and demanding and getting in people's faces and threatening and so on. John Foster Dulles, I think, captured the concept nicely. The measure of success, he says, is not whether or not we have problems. It's whether they're the same problems we had last year. The problems recur when we're unable to confront, discuss, and resolve them. So, having seen this, we began a study of people who, in those moments, seemed to do really well. I watched on Wednesday night a young Baha'i woman, actually an American, who in an intimate moment in a one-on-one conversation with Mr. Ahmadinejad had an opportunity to talk to him about the incredible persecution that her people suffer in Iran. So how do you have a conversation like that? I mean, do you start it with, how are you going to win back the people who hate you? Is that how you begin? Or do you start it by sugarcoating? Do you start by saying, you know, we got some issues and concerns? How do you do this? How can you express the full magnitude of your concern in a way that doesn't rupture the relationship? There are two ideas I'd like to share that I think profoundly affect our capacity to do exactly that. And I will also recommend that you make serious study of this topic because I think it has the effect that we're describing. So the first thing I'm going to get you to do is go back with your partner one last time, your A and B person. And one of you this time will be Jackie, the other Scott. So who was Bonnie before? Raise your hand if you were Bonnie. Okay, your name is now Scott. You're the boss. You're the guy on the right. Other person, your name is Jackie. You're the woman on the left. Raise your hand if you're Jackie. Okay, here it is. I'm going to teach you the first way we screw up a crucial conversation. All right. So what I want you to do, all the Jackies in the room, as soon as this stops, and I'll give you a little bit of warning as it's coming, I want you to turn to Scott and say the next thing you would say if you were her. Scott is the boss. Jackie is one of his direct reports. Here's the exchange.
Wait a second. You give me this restaurant gift certificate, and you say it's a reward for my good work, and that I should take my husband with me.
Well, you deserved it.
Then I find out it's for Friday night, the night of my daughter's birthday party. And it's not really for my husband and me. We have to take a client, who, by the way, drinks like a fish, and we don't drink, to a steakhouse, and we don't eat meat. And worst of all, you set this whole thing up behind my back. Is that about right?
Well, yeah.
Thanks. but no thanks.
Come on. These guys really like you, and they're really big buyers.
I'm sorry, Scott. You'll have to get someone else to do it.
Hey, didn't I fight for you on your last promotion? And didn't I go out on a limb to tell everyone you were a team player? Was I mistaken?
All right. Turn to Scott. Was he mistaken? What's your next sentence? Go. So here's a principle I want to teach you. One of the reasons you and I so consistently fail in our crucial conversations is because we handle the very first sentence wrong in two ways that I'll describe. So we talked a little bit about how we tend not to hold them. I want to talk about how when we hold them, we don't hold them particularly well. So here's the point. When you open your mouth, right? When Scott just says to you, "I said you were a team player, was I mistaken?" Right? Scott sets you up like that. When you open your mouth and say the very first sentence, you make a choice. And the choice that we make is often one that we're unconscious of having made. It happens to us automatically. So let me illustrate this for just a second. So when I say to you, I said you were a team player, was I mistaken? What's your first sentence?
If I'm a team player, why didn't you let me know about what the plans you were making for the team?
Okay, very good. So he starts with, if I'm a team player, why didn't you tell, or if I'm not a team player, why didn't you tell me about the plans you made on my behalf? How many of you started in some form of that? Talking about the plans, so forth. Good. Okay, so that's a place we can begin. How about another one? So I said you were a team player. Was I mistaken?
Well, I'd like to think I'm a team player, but if I'm a team player and part of a team, you should have communicated with me beforehand.
Okay, good. So he says, if I'm supposed to be a team player, you should communicate with me. Now, here's what I want to illustrate. As soon as I open my mouth, I've picked a topic. Is that right? One of the unconscious things you and I frequently do is pick a topic. As soon as I open my mouth, I've chosen the rabbit I'm going to chase. And if the rabbit I'm going to chase is, you didn't talk to me about making a commitment on my time, then I'll chase that rabbit. If the rabbit I'm going to chase is, I'm a team player, that's where the conversation goes. Does that make sense? Yeah. What other issues are going on here that you might want to be talking with him about? I want you to think about this for a moment. We've got all sorts of stuff happening, right? We've got that you lied to me. Is that on the table? Yeah, now we may not want to use that word, but what do you call it when somebody hands you something and says it's a gift certificate when it's really what?
Work.
Yeah, work. It's an assignment. What do you call it in English when somebody says it's a gift certificate but it's really an assignment? What do we call that? Yeah, lying! This is called lying, right? You lied to me. It's what you did. So if we don't want to sugarcoat the brownies, the conversation could be about you lied to me. And then when I didn't go along with what you said, what did you start to do to me? Hey, you start to guilt trip me or manipulate me or blackmail me. Even worse, you basically threaten my job. Are those issues you might want to talk about? Yeah. Now, I want to acknowledge that those are extraordinarily difficult to talk about. But I need to set that aside for a moment. The first question to ask is not what can we talk about, but what should we talk about? That's the first thing you ask. When you open your mouth, you choose a topic. When that client says to you they dropped the $5,000 that they were supposed to put in the retirement account on a boat instead, if the first thing you talk about is how unwise a boat investment is, you picked a topic, and you picked the wrong one. So let me share with you two danger signs that I hope you'll write down. This is the second thing I'd encourage you to commit to writing that are evidence that you're on the wrong topic. These come from our work on what we call crucial confrontations, not conversations, but confrontations. But here they are. If during a conversation you find yourself getting increasingly frustrated, so if you enter the conversation this bugged, but as it proceeds you're this bugged, that means there's something else going on that you're not discussing right now that's really driving the conversation. So I would contend that if Jackie starts talking about Friday night and you made commitments on my time without talking to me, that her anger is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger because she's on the wrong topic. It isn't about Friday night. It isn't about you made a promise to a client without talking to me. It's about something far bigger than that. Second, the second warning sign you have to watch for is if you ever have the same conversation twice. Because if you do, you're having the wrong conversation. If Scott has done this to you before, and I'm talking to him about how important Friday night is and my daughter's birthday party and all the plans we've made, the problem is not Scott, the problem is me, because I'm on the wrong topic. If this has happened multiple times, the topic is something entirely different than Friday night and making commitments without consulting with me. But that's what you and I do. What we tend to do is talk about what just happened or what's easiest to discuss rather than what's really happening. So what I want to share with you, and I apologize, our time is compressed, but I'm going to share with you a very useful tool, and I will encourage you to study this even more deeply, that can help you to tease this problem out, to get on the right topic. The tool helps you do this. Helps you recognize when you're stuck at one level of conversation and when what you need to do is move a level deeper. The tool is something we call CPR. It turns out that there are three different levels of conversation that you and I occasionally need to have, and we're usually on the wrong one in these crucial moments. The first is the content level. The content level is what just happened. It's the immediate pain or problem. The content issue is Friday night and the birthday party. Frequently, though, the problem isn't the content, but we're still talking about content. The problem is not the $5,000 down payment on a boat. The problem is that this is a pattern with this client. And what we need to be talking about is not the boat, but the pattern, which is an entirely different issue. Does that make sense? But what you and I tend to do is talk louder and louder and more persuasively about the boat rather than about the pattern. Or what we tend to do in our marriages is we wait for a new content issue to come up and then we scream and yell about the pattern. But our pattern conversation is entirely lost because they're going to defend what just happened and all the content issue. What you need to do is have a pattern conversation at a separate moment in time and not wait for a new content issue to emerge. Finally, I would argue the real conversation Jackie needs to hold is one that sounds like this. Boss, and these aren't the words we're going to encourage her to use, but this is the message she has to get across. Boss, you just lied to me and then threatened my job when I wouldn't roll over for you. That's the conversation she needs to have. It's a relationship conversation about trust or about competence or about respect. When you've concluded that a colleague is fundamentally incompetent, if you continue to talk about content issues like pulling your shirt off and resembling a dinosaur in the middle of a client call, if that's the level of your conversation, you've missed the entire point of the conversation. It's something much more fundamental about, do you even know how to behave in client relationships? Not, can you please not do the Jurassic thing again? And what tends to happen is you and I get on the wrong topic. So issue one, anytime you find yourself stuck, there tend to be crucial conversations that are keeping us there. Issue two, frequently it's not just that we're not talking, it's that we're not talking about the right things. We need to make sure we're on the right topic. Issue three then is, having identified the right topic, how do we bring it up? How can I discuss this in a way that could possibly ever work? Now, I'm going to share with you something staggering. We've spent about 10,000 hours cumulatively watching people in the course of conversations like what I saw with President Ahmadinejad on Wednesday night. We've watched some of the most challenging and emotionally and politically risky conversations you could possibly imagine. And we've watched some of those conversations go remarkably well. And we've watched some of them go predictably poorly. And then we started to ask ourselves, can you see by how people behave which direction it's headed? And these are the seven skills that we found that people like you and I use when it works. And you already know them all. We already use these. We're often just unconscious of the fact that we're using them. Now, our time is limited, so I have time to only share one of them with you. But this is one that deserves a disproportionate amount of our attention as well. But rather than me just tell it to you, I want you to watch it. So that conversation between Jackie and Scott, that wasn't hypothetical. I actually watched that happen. I actually watched the boss and the direct report and them dealing with this concern. And then I watched the direct report do what you're about to see. So I want you to join me in the research for a moment and ask yourself, what would you write down if you were the researcher? When you watch how this goes, what would you attribute it to? What skills is Jackie using that is making this come out the way it does? Because this is the way it came out.
Didn't I go out on a limb and tell everyone you were a team player? Was I mistaken?
I can see we're in a tough spot here. You want someone to take out a couple of important clients, and you've already promised them a night on the town. Is that about right?
That's exactly right.
Well, I don't want to disappoint a client any more than you do, Scott. But just as important, I want a relationship where you're up front with me. rather than making arrangements first and then talking to me about it afterwards.
Okay, but please don't bail on me, because I've already got the whole thing set up.
Now, I'm going to pause it for a second. Do you notice what's happening? What level of conversation is the boss trying to have? Content, pattern, or relationship? He's trying to take it to content, to Friday night. What's she trying to have? She's trying to go to relationship. Watch this.
You know, that's a big part of the problem here. You schedule the dinner with the client, present it to me as a reward, then hint that if I don't do what you want, I'm not a team player. That doesn't feel right. To be honest, it feels manipulative. Did it happen that way, or did I miss something?
Well, yeah, but I knew if I asked you before, you'd say no. And these guys are really important.
All right, let's tackle these things one at a time. First, I'd like for us to find a way to work together honestly, without games. I'd like both of us to be comfortable about how we establish plans.
I don't know what to say.
Well, I'm curious. Why did you feel like you had to set up the dinner with the client first, then present it as a reward?
All right. Well, let me ask you as researchers a question. How many of you, by show of hands, would give her pretty high marks for honesty? Yeah, I would too. I wrote down the same thing watching this. Second, how many of you think there's at least a good chance that that relationship could still be intact when this is done? I think that, yeah. Now, I can tell you the outcome, and that is the relationship wasn't only still intact, it was stronger at the other side because she dealt with this the way she did. So I want you to turn to your partner, and if you were the researcher, what's one thing you would point out that she did right? What's a skill that she used there that you would attribute the success to? Real quick, one thing, 30 seconds, go. Okay, good. Now, I want you to be thinking on that because I want you to test your experience with that against what I'm about to say, because I want to leave us with a challenge. The challenge is this. You and I, from the time we were remarkably small, like the kids in the video, were taught a damnable myth. And I use that word intentionally. We were taught a myth that has caused no end of mischief in our lives and in our organizations. That myth is that the predictor of your success or failure in a crucial conversation is how risky the issue is. That's what we believe. And it's a lie. So telling somebody their brownies are horrible, that's really risky. Telling your boss that he just lied to you and is now blackmailing you and that you won't accept that, that's really risky. So this isn't going to work. That's what we believe. We believe if it's a big, hairy, ugly issue, you can't talk about it. That's what we believe. And it is patently, absolutely false. And the fact that we believe that it's true causes us to behave in ways that causes no end of mischief in our lives. Here's what we know to be true after watching thousands and thousands of hours of conversations like that. The issue is not the riskiness of the topic. The issue is your capacity to create safety. That's the predictor. Your capacity to help the other person feel psychologically safe discussing the issue with you is the predictor of your success or failure in that conversation. People don't get defensive with you because of what you're saying. They get defensive because of why they think you're saying it. It's the intent, not the content, that creates that lack of safety. Let me end with one quick illustration of this that I think was absolutely profound to me. I watched on Wednesday night as this Baha'i woman came up to a head of state, to President Ahmadinejad. And after I'd witnessed this interaction earlier, after I watched somebody in the room say, well, you know, why does everybody hate you and how are you going to get them to stop hating you, and watched him deal with it diplomatically with a scripted answer and off the cuff and all prepared, and because he's used to this, right? He knows it come into this. I watched this Baha'i woman come up to him at the end of this meeting and one-on-one chat with President Ahmadinejad. And she said, I noticed you had representatives of all the religious minorities up on the stand with you. She said, I applaud that. I respect that. I admire that. And I hope that that's true in Iran. President Ahmadinejad said, why, thank you. We work our best to make sure this is true. She said, but I'm deeply troubled because there was one religious minority not represented up there. And he said, who would that be? She said, the Baha'i. And he said, oh, the Baha'i are not a religion, they're a political movement, and they're illegal in Iran. And then he looked at this blue-eyed, blonde-haired, fair-skinned American woman speaking to him in Farsi, in his tongue, who with tears in her eyes said, "I am an American and am one of thousands of Baha'i who worship here. We are a religion." To which he said, "Oh no, you're not right. It's a political movement and they're illegal and they have no rights in Iran because it's a mischievous movement." To which she said, "Please, President Ahmadinejad, listen to me. It is a religion. And I challenge you to go back and make sure that they have representation as well." Now, he could have had a scripted response. He could have had a prepared response. But there was something about the way she presented herself such that his mouth opened and closed. He uttered no words. He looked down at the ground. And then he said, "I'll see what I can do." Something changed. Something changed. And it wasn't because the issue was not emotionally or politically risky. It's because somebody was able to approach it in a way that created safety for them to talk about the issue. Now, do I know that that changes the world in Iran? No, I don't know that. But what I do fundamentally believe is that that moment got a message across that would otherwise never have been heard. Our capacity to do the same is far greater than we suspect. And if we learn to do that, we handle these moments of disproportionate influence in a way that produce much better results, not just in our professional, but in our personal lives. I thank you for your time. I would encourage you, if you want to study the topic further, I think they have copies of the book available in the store. I would encourage you also to fill the little cards out, and we'd be happy to email you some study materials that would help you in the efforts. And I wish you the best in all your crucial conversations. Thank you.